Let me start this morning with a confession, because I know that's how you want all of your ministers to start their sermons while the senior pastor is on sabbatical. The confession is, there's some irony in me getting up here to preach about prayer. Prayer has never come naturally to me. It is rarely my first thought in a given situation. Many of you are incredible prayer warriors, and for that I am thankful. But this is a gift that I do not possess. But of course, I value prayer. I've seen it work firsthand, both in small ways and in life-changing ways. I have also felt the disappointment and complexity of a prayer that was answered in a way that I didn't want. Our passage this week brought out some questions for me, and I hope they can also be questions for you. Who taught you to pray? How do you pray? What do you pray for? Who do you pray for? It's easy for me to think about my preschool and children's Sunday school teachers who taught me to pray with my hands together, my eyes closed, and my head bowed. I would pray for people I knew, for the trees and the bunnies, for my favorite TV show. Then I got older and more sophisticated into my elementary school years, and I started praying for things that really matter, like a win in my next baseball game, or a friend and I would routinely pray that we would come home from school to our bedrooms bursting full of Lego from floor to ceiling. These are the crucial, life-changing prayers for a seven-year-old, of course, though sadly the Lego prayer always seemed to be a no. When I was in high school and college, I started to watch other people and their prayer life. Ministers at church, mentors, even some friends. It was then that I began to realize that prayer, as I was seeing it modeled, was difficult for me, and it did not come naturally. I was on our youth leadership team in my youth group. I knew I wanted to go into ministry as a sophomore in high school. I studied religion and philosophy in college. I was a faithful attender of church. I was being hired as youth interns and college ministry interns. I was preparing myself for seminary and a vocation that I love, and yet, I often felt like a hypocrite. Prayer had seemed easy when I could pray for a Lego or to get a hit off of tough pitcher or for the health of the bunny rabbit that I had seen that morning. But now, how could I be a good Christian, much less a minister, when I struggle so much with prayer? So I found a solution. Like all good nerds, especially religion nerds, I bought a bunch of books about prayer, because it's that easy, right? Richard Foster, Henry Nouwen, Thomas Merton, countless others. I even bought a book on how to pray through the Psalms. They're all great books and great resources, but as you might expect, they didn't change me into C.S. Lewis, who wrote a book literally called How to Pray. And like I said earlier, I know that some of you are incredible prayer warriors. Others of you are good about giving thanks before meals and praying for those at the top of our church prayer list. But I'm also betting some of you have many days where you feel a lot like me when it comes to prayer. No matter your relationship with prayer, Jesus has something to say to all of us in this passage. In our text today, the disciples asked Jesus, "Lord, teach us to pray." They had seen Jesus praying. They even acknowledged knowing that John the Baptist had taught his followers how to pray, and the disciples wanted in on that action. What comes from Jesus is Luke's version of the Lord's Prayer, and now the one that we know best and the one we offer God most often in worship comes from the Gospel of Matthew, but here Luke gives us a version that then leads into some really interesting teaching about prayer from Jesus. Jesus gives the Lord's Prayer, and from there, Scripture doesn't record if the disciples had any follow-up questions or thoughts or snide remarks. Instead, Jesus immediately proceeds into a parable and then two metaphors. The parable is about a family who receives company late in the evening. Custom at the time was to provide the traveler with a meal and a place to sleep. The only problem was that this family didn't have any food left over from their meals that day. So the head of the household goes to the neighbor's house and asks for their leftover bread. In these small one or two room houses, people were not cooking indoors, so it was common for neighbors to know who had made how much bread and food and who might be the most likely to have leftovers. Today, there is no chance that we go next door and ring the doorbell in the middle of the night and ask our neighbor for food so that we can feed our guests. It is unheard of, but for this culture, the opposite was true. Alan Culpepper, renowned New Testament scholar, and as luck would have it, my dean at the seminary where I attended, points out that the parable asks whether anyone listening could imagine a situation in which one would go to a friend in the middle of the night and be told by the neighbor that he could not get up to give his friend the bread he needed because he and his family were asleep. To get up in the middle of the night, get the bread, and draw the bolt on the door would awaken the whole family. Would a neighbor turn away a friend in the middle of the night and allow him to be shamed because he would not provide hospitality for a guest? We hear that and we think, yeah, neighbor, go to bed. Ask me in the morning. Listeners at the time would hear that and think, oh my goodness, no, I am getting up, I am getting up. Saying no to this neighbor knocking on your door would be unimaginable in a Galilean village. It is unthinkable not to help your neighbor when you have the means to do so, even in the middle of the night when it would involve waking up your entire family. Culpepper goes on to say, the situation is not unthinkable because of the petitioner's persistence, but because of the honor demanded that a neighbor get up, awaken his whole family if necessary, and supply the neighbor's need. If not from friendship, then at least to avoid being shamed. And shame would fall on both the neighbor and yourself. Avoiding shame, friendship, whatever the reason, Jesus uses this parable to reframe teaching on prayer to be an act of neighborly love. From this parable, we learn that we can pray with confidence. God will provide what we need, not necessarily because we've asked enough times to nag God into a yes, but because we know that God is even more trustworthy and gracious than a neighbor, especially in a time of need. But Jesus isn't finished there. Jesus goes on to give a double metaphor about a parent and their child. What parent would give their child a snake instead of a fish, or a scorpion instead of an egg? Now, admittedly, I might be the only parent on the planet whose kid would actually appreciate a snake or a scorpion as those gifts. And if Autumn was in town, perhaps Finn too, but that is not the point. In the context of this passage, Jesus is again reframing prayer as a tangible act of love. The two questions, the two metaphors compare the goodness of a human parent with the even greater goodness of God. Hopefully, from our life experiences, we know that a parent will answer the questions with what is best for the child. Sometimes the answer is, here's a fish, here's an egg. And sometimes it's, not now, because you'll ruin your dinner. Or in the case of the middle schoolers at camp this past week, no, you can't have M&Ms from my room at midnight. Either way, the hope is that the answer is what's best for the child. If we trust parents grandparents, and caregivers to do that? Shouldn't we trust God to do what's best for us when we call out in need? I was taught that prayer is a conversation with God, and it is. Sometimes those are private conversations, and sometimes those are corporate conversations. Prayer is a conversation with God. But we also know from our experiences on this planet as human beings, with emotions, with drama, with loves, with hardships, conversations don't always involve words. In these 13 verses, Jesus reframes a major aspect of prayer to include actions, presence, and understanding the need that is before you. These are among the very things God does for us. So when the disciples ask Jesus to teach them to pray, Jesus does and then responds by teaching them about the very nature of God. God is with you. God understands you. God knows what you need. The nature of God is a part of our life of prayer. How cool is that? How expansive is that? How much does that blow open the boundaries of how we understand prayer? Now, admittedly, I'm not sure if my 7-year-old Lego self, praying self, would have gotten it, but it has opened up a whole new world of understanding a life of prayer for me in recent years. But what does that look like outside of a metaphor and some parables? 7-year-old praying me may not have gotten it, but I am confident that 7-year-old church-going me would have already memorized verses 9 and 10 and was one step closer to this broader understanding. Those verses say, "So I say to you, ask and it will be given to you. Search and you will find. Knock and the door will be opened to you. Because everyone who searches finds, and everyone who asks will receive, and for everyone who knocks, the door will be open for you." As an adult, I have come back to these memory verses many times. Now, the youth will also tell you that I am not big on pushing memorization. It most often robs the verses of their context. Things can get twisted and turned to say things they're not actually saying, and all of that. But sometimes, those verses we memorize as a kid, especially in a place that is teaching memorization responsibly, is step one on a long journey of discovery. I know now there is a power and depth in these verses that is almost impossible to convey in a 7-year-old Sunday school class, but that also doesn't mean we should stop trying. In our prayer life, we are told to ask, to seek, and to knock. And if we're paying attention, we'll notice these directions from Jesus put us in the position of the vulnerable. Going back to Dr. Culpepper, he says, and I'm paraphrasing this one, asking in the hope that something will be given to us puts us in the posture of a beggar. Seeking and finding is language common to a search for wisdom, but it could have wider applications, perhaps even seeking lodging or shelter. Similarly, knocking in the hope of being received somewhere again puts us in the posture of the destitute and those experiencing homelessness. When we pray, we are humbling ourselves, opening up and being vulnerable. And in these teachings of Jesus, we can understand that sometimes the answers to our prayers come from people around us, friends, neighbors, family, even strangers. If our call to prayer puts us in these humbling positions, how then are we to respond when others ask, seek, or knock? Based on the words of Jesus, part of our prayer life needs to be loving action in response to others. Evidence of a different kind of conversation with God. When we were in Birmingham last month for our youth mission trip, we had a ton of incredible experiences. Two of these opportunities that were separate on our schedule ended up coming full circle to work together to provide a perfect illustration for what Jesus is teaching us. On Monday evening, we watched a documentary detailing the 1963 Birmingham Children's March. Birmingham was famously considered the most racist city in the South, so you may remember that this is the Civil Rights March where adults in the community were afraid of losing their jobs or losing their mortgages, so they could not rally for this cause. Instead, children left school in the middle of the day and marched. They were sprayed with fire hoses. They were attacked by police dogs. They were put in police paddy wagons. They were taken to temporary jail cells, some of which were literally the pigsties at the Birmingham fairgrounds. Children as young as 4 years old were jailed that day. That's how old our kid Margot is. No part of me can imagine her being put in jail and served moldy bologna at mealtimes. These children put it all on the line to advance the cause of justice. On Tuesday afternoon, we had the chance to meet someone who participated in the Children's March. Dr. Gwen Cook Webb came and told us her story. She put a personal face on the movement, and through her natural lens of joy, she talked to us about the pain and the hardship, about rallying her friends to participate, and about going to jail. She talked to us about the progression that has happened since then, and our youth were able to begin to understand the depth of how the Children's March reshaped the entire civil rights movement in Birmingham, starting with children and teenagers. Separate from that, we had a chance to serve at a place called Community on the Rise, which offers a welcome space for people who are experiencing homelessness. We got to sit and talk with them as they participated in what they called table talk, which is a time where individuals gather, answer questions, and engage in storytelling. It's a space for humanity, personalization, and an opportunity for folks who are so often overlooked to be welcomed and loved and called by name. And then on the next day, Wednesday, we saw the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute and the 16th Street Baptist Church in the morning, and we took our lunch to Kelly Ingram Park, which is the site of the Birmingham Children's March. That is the place where the fire hoses were. That is the place where the police dogs were. That is the place where these children were arrested. After we finished our lunch, the youth had a chance to explore this small park, and a few of our middle school guys went over and talked to a gentleman who was sitting on a bench. This man was very clearly homeless, but that did not stop our youth, and they invited this man back over to our group to share his story. He shared what he had told these guys already. He was also part of the Children's March. He had scars on his body from the dog bites, and he told us how much it meant to him that we were engaging in this work even now. We sat with him, we ate with him, we sang with him, we heard his stories. And then at the end, a few youth, all on their own, started to pull out some of their money and giving it to this man. Not simply out of charity, but out of an understanding of the deeper connection to how this man's life played into something larger, and they wanted to support him and to support that. It was here that our youth identified an opportunity, whether they realized it or not, to take their life of prayer to the next level, to make it that loving action that Jesus is talking about. They put themselves out there in a way that says, I would wake up my entire family if necessary to give this neighbor of mine what he needs. That is an act of prayer. Maybe we're being called to expand our prayer life to include loving action for women's rights, for rights and inclusion of our LGBTQ friends, for rights for migrant people, for dignity for our siblings experiencing homelessness, or for so many other examples. A call for loving action are the prayers of our friends at the IRC, Greensboro Urban Ministry, Backpack Beginnings, and our other mission partners. This past week at Passport Camp, our youth had the chance to serve our own Greensboro community at their mission site by partnering with Family Room, a nonprofit that serves and resources families who are fostering children. What seemed like simple acts of sorting, organizing, and hanging clothes allows this organization to put more of their resources into the families they serve. That too is opening the door for your neighbor. That too is an act of prayer. It could mean participating in a meal train. It could mean watering plants in our community garden. It could mean dropping food in the Greensboro Urban Ministry donation boxes in the atrium. The examples are endless. Jesus' teachings offer us assurance that we worship a God who gives, opens, and allows us to find. So whether it's us asking, seeking, and knocking, which many of you are so good at, God will provide what we need. When it's others asking, seeking, and knocking, we can be the hands and feet of God and serve others as an act of ongoing prayer. And so I want to ask again, how do you pray? Because not every conversation with God uses words. Amen.